Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will be finding common ground and taking it to the next level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. This show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. It's my hope that you will come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. Now, this is a no-holds-barred show. My guests will have differing spiritual belief systems, and some will have no spiritual beliefs. You may or you may not agree with things that are said. What I'd ask you to do is keep an open mind. This way, you can see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now, today, my guest is Jim A., and Jim is in a 12-step program, so he is remaining anonymous as far as his last name goes. That is the tradition of 12-step programs. I just wanted to mention that my upcoming guests next week, I'm going to have Cyrus Webb, who is a radio show host, very popular show host. And then I'm having the best-selling author, Brian McNaught, on next Friday at 7:30 p.m. He's written several gay-affirming books that are spiritually oriented. So now I'm going to read you Jim's biography, and then I will introduce you to him. Jim's father was a police officer, and his mother was a stay-at-home mom. He had two brothers and two sisters. He received a strict Catholic upbringing and went to parochial school until the seventh grade. He moved to Bangkok, Thailand in 1964 and lived there until 1973 while his father was working for the United States government in Vietnam. He joined the United States Army in 1979 and remained in the Army for 15 years. During his life, he developed addictions to alcohol, drugs, and sex. He became sober from alcohol in 1984, but relapsed in 1998. In 2007, he was picked up by the VA homeless program, and he has remained sober from sex, alcohol, and drugs since then. So, Jim, are you there?
Well, hi, David. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I am fine. Nice to be on your show, and thank you very, very much for asking me to come on board here.
Well, I am awfully glad to have you, Jim, and I'm glad that you have summoned up the courage to give an interview about your challenging but rewarding life. And I know that it's been a life of despair and triumph. I wondered if you could tell me a little bit about your early childhood and your family of origin.
Absolutely. I was born and, well, partially raised anyway, in Spokane, Washington. My father and was a sheriff's officer, and through my time growing up in Spokane, he came to become a captain of the sheriff's office of Spokane County. My mother was a stay-at-home mom, of course, and I have one older sister, one younger sister, and two younger brothers. So I grew up Catholic, although, to tell you the truth, I never really paid much attention to it. I had the nuns and the priests and all the stuff that goes with it. And it was pre-Vatican II, so it was an interesting time, I suppose, but I was more into the play thing. My father was very, very strict, and what he said went. And unfortunately, I don't think that he had much love from his father. And so there were a lot of corporal punishment, so to speak. And I learned at an early age that I know now that I wasn't really able to feel or to express myself in any way. So words were hard. And my mother would just kind of stand by and let it happen. Whether she was afraid of my father or not, I really don't know. But these things happen, to make us susceptible, I'm assuming, for addiction. And I think I was an addict waiting to happen. And I know you being in 12 steps, I know you've heard that one before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I sure have. And I can relate to that, too. I think that I was as well. Now, would you characterize the corporal punishment as physical abuse?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. What I'm seeing now through recovery, by the grace of God through recovery, is a lot of things that I can relate to when it comes to the what we call the inner child or the childhood times. And mine was, if anything went wrong, I was beat. I learned very early that after I was beat, I was sent to bed. And then what I did know, but I know now, of course, that my father felt guilty, so he'd come downstairs to my bedroom and tell me he loved me. So my idea was love was no intimacy and beat until you're loved, or so to speak. So, I do not believe in any form of corporal punishment with a child.
I don't either. Was there any other childhood trauma for you, Jim?
Before Thailand, not really. I mean, the trauma was with my father. Most of it was with my father. I remember a couple times when I would do bad at school, he'd put me in his sheriff's car and go down to Skid Row and point out the bums who were running from a sheriff's car, I remember that, and telling me that I would be just like them. And I remember, I sprained my ankle one time, and on the way to the emergency room, I couldn't cry because I knew if I did, he'd give me something to cry about. So he was very, very strict in that way. And it was pretty rotten. Pretty rotten, David.
It sounds it, yeah. Well, can you tell me a little bit about your coming-of-age years and the unique experience you had doing that in Thailand and also when your addictions began?
Sure. First of all, David, I must say that I personally, and nobody's really sure of this, but I personally believe that I was born predisposed to addiction. I don't know exactly what that means. I'll leave that to the experts. I'm not interested in that. But when I was in the, just at the end of the sixth grade, we moved to Bangkok, Thailand. My father was approached by the U.S. government and asked if he would be a police advisor to the Saigon Police Department in Vietnam, and he could bring his family over to the nearest safe haven, which was Bangkok, Thailand. And so we went over there, and you need to know that that was in the mid-60s, and it was wild. It was during the Vietnam War. Bangkok was one of the three famous R&R spots for the GIs. It was wide open, sex, drugs, and rock and roll to the T. Drugs were incredibly cheap. For instance, and this is the truth, I'll never forget it. One time we bought a kilo of Thai pot for $5, which was quite a lot of money back then in Thai era. And it was also in the Golden Triangle, so heroin was 99% pure. And anything else. Now, the Thai police left us alone. They left all Americans alone. They just, handled their own. And as a kid, when I started drinking, which I remember blacking out the first time I started drinking, I went wild. And smoking pot and Tide Pod and sniffing heroin, which I really didn't like, thank God, and all the other drugs that I had found. And then when I was, I think I was a freshman in high school, when we went to we found out an Air Force guy had a lot of booze, and we could go to his apartment. And we, as kids, we went there and free booze and all the stuff we wanted, and I was sexually abused by him. And what happened there was it brought me into a shame that my father always taught, you know, sex was bad, by the way, and it brought me into a shame. It put me in a very black place, and it was just a terrible ordeal for me. And later on, my first prostitute was when I was 13 years old. You know, I think it was 13 or 14. I believe it was 13, though, which cost one American dollar. And so, I mean, it was like from the beginning, there was never any, you know, with a woman, so to speak, there was never any petting or dating. And there was never any social interplay unless there was drugs or alcohol involved in it. So from a very early age, I was on this course to spiritual, moral, and physical destruction.
And it sounds like your addictions played off of one another also.
Yes, that's a good point, David. In my opinion, you know, being in the 12-step fellowship, and I can have my own, but in my opinion, some people say that one addiction leads to another, or if you stop one, you go to another. I disagree with that. I think that I was addicted to alcohol, drugs, and especially sex. From the beginning, and I just didn't really think about the sexual one that much, or in that respect, David, not till years later did I realize I was an alcoholic, but I believe that they all interplayed or intertwined together at the same time, and I didn't switch one for another. They were always there. They were always there. And I was addicted from the beginning, and like all addictions, it was a progressive state to them. And that includes sex. A lot of people don't know that, but there is definitely, as we say in the program, a lot of not yets that in the years to come I would cross that line, so to speak.
Well, which of the addictions was the most difficult for you to deal with in recovery?
Without a doubt, it was sexual addiction. And I think for any of your listeners out there, this is very important to hear. Without a doubt, it was sexual addiction. And let me tell you why, at least in, again, my opinion. Alcohol and drugs you can physically pick up and put into your system. Now, that's not to say that they're not hard. You know, they almost killed me, physically killed me. But you can see what you're putting down, or you can see what you're giving up. Well, I now know that God gave me sexuality as God gave every human being. And what a beautiful gift, a very strong gift, but a beautiful gift. And through the years and through the sexual abuse and the teachings of my father, you know, bad, and all that, I had... perverted, out of kilter in my sexual ways of, you know, in the addiction itself. So to put it down, David, is impossible, because that is part of me. That will always be part of me. So unlike the other programs where the gift is, oh my gosh, you know, the alcohol has been taken from me, the obsession, the thoughts and all that. Well, sexual addiction is different in that every day, as a man, I am tempted. Every day. The difference is today that there's no obsession behind it, and it's okay if I am tempted, because I got to remember it is a gift from God, and it's just okay.
Well, that's a real grace to have the obsession lifted. That is
yes.
a big part of the disease, and as I see it, since I share that disease, it all starts with a thought, and thoughts are powerful. And what an addict does, or what I did, and it sounds like what you did, was fed on those thoughts until they became an obsession. And that happens very quickly for me. And then the next thing that happens is that I feel compelled to act on the thought. And that's why we call it acting out when we go into the arena of sexual addiction and engage in a sexual behavior. And
Absolutely.
What that means is we're acting out usually some unresolved or some negatively charged feeling that we don't want to feel, like anxiety, depression, anger. Name some other ones, Jim.
Absolutely. There's rage. There's very subtle things, too, that's in our unconscious. There's a famous saying in AA is that I drank because it was Tuesday. You know, so there's some unconscious things that go on in this all the time where the steps really come into play, thank God, because for no reason at all we can be triggered. Well, of course there's a reason, but we're unconscious of that. But one for me, if I was to call these anonymous, beautiful 12-step programs by another name, I think I would call them all a search for intimacy. Because usually when my character flaws, one of my biggest character defects, so to speak, is the fear of rejection. And when that happens to me, David, it's still instantaneous. I am triggered. The difference today, and that trigger turns into obsession, and that obsession turns into acting out. And once I'm on that road, there is no stopping. It's impossible. I have to finish that. And then comes the incredible toxic shame that basically swings me back next trigger. So as you can tell, that's that incredible vicious cycle. But the difference now is the triggers when I'm hit. I can feel the trigger, and sometimes it takes me a while, but usually I can say, uh-oh, here we go. But there's no obsession because, David, God has removed that from me one day at a time. And it wasn't just something that God gave me. It came through hell. It came through living a hell that I could never forget. So even though the 12-step programs are free, I earned that chair to sit down in those meetings, and I think you have too, right, David?
I have.
So, well,
a front row seat.
Front row seat. And, you know,
I love
words, and, you know, there's this one thing about before you get sober, you know, hitting bottom, we all call it, you know. One of the things is, and in the lowest deep, a lower deep, still threatening to devour me, opens wide to which hell I suffer seems a heaven. And I can go lower
and
lower. Where
does that come from?
I have it somewhere. Wow. It's not me. You know, I'm not much at writing, but I do love reading. And there is a Greek philosopher, and I cannot pronounce his name, but he gives me one more that I'll read, and then I'll stop that. But I love this. And
okay.
This is pain that cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart until in our despair there comes wisdom through the awesome grace of God.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, and it's
Well,
true.
I think you pointed out a couple of really significant things. You talked about shame and how that drives the cycle, and it is a vicious cycle because the shame is so toxic. It makes me feel so bad when I feel that shame that I need to get rid of it, and the knee-jerk reaction is to go to the addiction. And the other thing that you spoke of that I think is significant is that fear of intimacy. And I've heard it said that this addiction and perhaps other ones too are an intimacy disorder, and that is based on fear. And so that's really significant. Yep. Now, you talked about the hell that you lived, and I know the power is in your testimony, so I would appreciate it if you would be willing to share your addiction and recovery story.
Yes. It was absolutely horrendous. Well, I'll say it this way. I had two spiritual experiences by the grace of God that led me into the 12 steps. The first was in 1984 in the Army. I was in a Special Forces unit stationed in Okinawa, 1st Special Forces unit in Okinawa, Japan. And I got a letter from an ex-wife that had just shot her husband, I'm sorry, that had just shot her boyfriend because he was beating her so much. And she wanted to know if I can come and visit her in Ohio. And at the time, David, I was, I didn't care about anybody or anything. And to me, that was just a ticket off the island on a emergency leave so that I can go to California and drink. And I drank, and I acted out sexually, of course. It always, always comes with it. And I drank until I woke up in the morning, one morning, in a hotel room, and there was empty bottles of gallon jugs of Cala Rossi Vin Rosé. But something was wrong. Something was wrong, and I had a little bit of wine left in one of the jugs, and I tried drinking it, and I couldn't. I went to the bathroom, and there was blood all over the toilet because of my puking throughout the night. I always black out anyway. But I remember looking into the mirror that day. Something was different. I looked at myself, and my eyes were dead. Think of a dead person on TV or whatever. The eye, just lifeless, no soul, death in my. And I don't know if that was a hallucination or anything, but I did go into DT soon after that, and that was the difference. And for 3 days, I had cigarettes and water and detoxed myself because I was too afraid to go out that door. When I got back to Okinawa, out of the blue, I went to an AA meeting, and then at the end of the meeting, they said the Lord's Prayer, and I felt this rush, this electric rush. I'll never forget it, and right now my hackles, the hair is rising on my arms, and the obsession for alcohol was 100% lifted, gone, completely gone, and I couldn't believe it. And I remember the next day saying, so this is what God feels like, you know. And I was in my latter 20s. But I didn't know. I would go to an AA meeting, now sober, and get an obsession and veer off toward the meeting and go to a place where you can get hookers. And then after I was done, I was wondering, what's wrong with me? I'm sober. What's wrong with me? Years later, the addiction to sex was so powerful that I started drinking again. After 13 years in the program, by the way, and this led to the DTs were so bad that I would take, not the DTs yet, but the next morning the jitters were so bad that I'd take Vicodin that I found through somebody. And then, of course, the not-yets with the sex, the street prostitutes, I found the drug crack. And crack was a whole new experience for me. So now it was drinking, Vicodin, crack, and prostitutes, all wrapped into one. And then through a series of just months, I lost my job, my car, my home, everything, and wouldn't call my sons, and ended up in the missionaries, you know, downtown, the soup kitchens and the homeless programs and everything. I was picked up and through the VA, put into a recovery program, but I had to detox first. David, I didn't know that Vicodin, the detox of Vicodin with alcohol would be so incredibly, the hell is I can't put into words. Even though they drug me up, I was in there for 64 days in-house after I withdrew from the drugs and the alcohol. And when I got out after 64 days, I was at a very low bottom because I knew that I was going to act out sexually again. And I knew that if I did, I would drink and take drugs. So I knew I was going to die, and I knew how I was going to die, you know, unless I ended up in prison. And so I went to a meeting for the sex addiction, a 12-step meeting, and it was in the winter, and I'm sitting on the bench. I was the first one there, so the church wasn't even opened. I'm sitting there waiting for the meeting, and I realized that how angry I was. And I asked God, I said, could you just please just remove the anger? I know I'm going to act up, but just the anger. And David, it's like, you know what sparklers are, like on the 4th of July. It started in my chest. And it started in my chest, and it started to burn. And it was a real burning sensation, like sparklers inside of my chest. And it spread. And I felt a peace that I have never felt before. And by the grace of God, I didn't know it then, but by the grace of God, God, the obsession to sexually act out from me that night, a second spiritual experience. And that was in 2007, and this is, 2014. So, by gosh, I got a couple days in, and without obsession, okay? So I can tell you right now, and mostly for anybody listening to this, that I am free. Today I am free, 100% free, only today, but I am free, David.
Well, that is a true gift. I know what that gift feels like, and it is like a miracle. And of course, we both know that the disease is characterized by powerlessness over the addictive behavior and the unmanageability that it creates in our lives. Can you talk a little bit about your powerlessness and cite some examples of how it made your life unmanageable?
Well, the powerlessness came in two ways. First of all, of course, I'm powerless over the act of addiction. Now, the first step of any 12-step program is I'm powerless over that my life had become unmanageable. But, you know, Dave, because of my father would never let me express myself, words are very, very important to me. So I like to use the word instead of powerless in the addiction as impossible. It was impossible for me to stop acting out. Drinking, drugs, and sex. It was impossible. It was absolutely impossible. And it wasn't until I came into the program, and it continues to be that way, by the way, but there is a power greater than myself that restores me to sanity. But the unmanageability in other areas, in all areas of my life, I've got an addictive personality. So I like to take over. I like to do things. I'm a perfectionist. You know, things I like to do things my way. And so a lot of times it's just through the pain of living when I'm going, oh, my God, Jim, you messed this up. And then I realize it's because I did not turn it over to the program, did not make the phone calls to people like you, did not do service work, which is the 12th step. These are the things that keep me on a peaceful, even keel. Otherwise, my life is unmanageable. So the first step is always with me, every day. Thank God.
Well, we're going to take a break now for a commercial, and then we will return for the rest of our interview with Jim.
Okay.
Prepare to be shocked. Prepare to be moved. Prepare to laugh. Prepare to cry. And prepare to be inspired. Dive into David Clark's latest book, Shades of Gay, and you will find yourself plunged into the trenches of sexual addiction. You will embark upon a kaleidoscopic tour from the abyss to higher ground. In the beginning, it was love at first sight when Daniel and Mark met, but through the years, that same love became tainted. Daniel, an alcoholic and sex addict, has found himself unable to resist the lure of other men. When Mark discovers his infidelity, he leaves Daniel, who begins a dark descent into sexual tryst after tryst. Shades of Gay reveals the myriad desires a lost man can permit his body and soul to revel in, despite the pain they bring. But can such fleeting moments of pleasure bring meaning to life? Will Daniel realize the love he had with Mark is worth more than the sweat spent in other men's beds?
And that's my latest book, Shades of Gay. And the answer to that last question is yes. He does find that there is something that is more worthwhile. And if you want to find out what that is, you'll need to read the book, which is available through Amazon.com. So, Jim,
yes.
You've told us quite a bit about your background. Give us an idea about the roots of the addiction and also what recovery has meant to you. Can you tell the audience, first of all, do you believe sexual addiction is a disease? And if so, can you tell the audience what makes it a disease, in your opinion?
Absolutely, and that's actually a very simple question to answer. Every addiction, which is a disease, is a disease because of one thing, that it progresses. Okay, an alcoholic that starts drinking, even in early days, showing signs of alcoholism, has years to grow as it progresses in his or her body. And it gets worse and worse and worse until it kind of flips to the other side where you are not enjoying it anymore. You are drinking for survival as it kills you, and it does kill. Same with drugs. And a lot of people don't get this, but it's the same with sex. What it does is it of course it feels good. I would be a liar if I say it didn't. You know, to go out and have a lot of women and all this stuff or whatever the addiction, the sex addiction is. And porn, by the way, is becoming huge. But the problem with it, let's just take porn, and that is not my addiction. It starts out simply watching and perhaps masturbating into watching for hours upon hours until it affects the job, your life, compulsive masturbation, and losing the family, not paying attention, or as myself with prostitutes, of course, the dangers, my God, in every way, it gets worse and worse and worse. And so a real addiction or a real disease simply progresses until it kills. And that's the same with sex addiction. Absolutely. Suicide on the installment plan,
yeah.
David.
And it happens, too. We know a couple of people within our own group in a rather small city who've committed suicide because of the disease,
yes.
And it's very sad, very sad situation.
Yes.
What steps have you taken to manage your addiction, Jim? Or I should say addictions.
Well, the first thing is rigorous honesty. if I am not honest, to be honest with myself, I have to bring it up and out or lead with my weakness to people in the group or on the phone calls or to little things. If I find somebody's purse on the floor, I'm not turning it in to be a good Samaritan. I'm turning it in to keep my sobriety. I mean, you have to really be honest. And the second one, of course, is meetings. Meetings, meetings, meetings. And the reason for that is it's not long after I leave a meeting, you know, in a day or two, I can enter back into the shadow land, I call it, back into the little drift of thinking, into the subtleties of addiction, addictive thinking, you know, that can turn dangerous. So a lot of meetings. And lastly, thirdly is the 12th step of these programs. It has been freely given to me, even though we all went through hell. I have to give it away, which I'm going to tell your audience quickly about you. One of the first people I called when I got out of a VA recovery was you. You were there. You met me and we talked. That saved my life. I will never forget it. That's how it works. And lastly, David, of course, is the beautiful phrase of God as we understand God. You know, that's so vital because it takes us off our mine is right, yours is wrong, to a place of an ineffable love that we can't explain, nor will we ever explain, that it's just love beyond our understanding is this God. And we can bring that into the programs, and that power greater than ourselves can and does miracles that have saved the lives of thousands upon thousands of peoples and their families.
Right, because it does affect the family. It becomes a family disease, if you will, or dis-ease.
Yes.
Now, you've mentioned several things that I want to go back to. One is you talked about having met me when you came out, and that's an example of grace. And as I see it, that's an example of God meeting your need and how God always meets our needs. If we look back on our lives, I look back on my life, and as I went through it, I couldn't see it. But I can see now that I wouldn't be here today if God hadn't met every single one of my needs, even in my deepest, darkest hours when I didn't think that there was any hope. He brought me through it and so met my needs at the time, maybe not in the way that I wanted, but in the way that I needed. The other thing is you mentioned the word sexual sobriety, and I'd like you to tell the audience what that means and what it means to you.
Sure. Sexual sobriety. Sexual sobriety is a spiritual search for one's own sexuality, which I think is quite common even in the non-addict. Sexual sobriety is me knowing, and there's three or four main S programs or sexual 12-step programs, and some of them have their own a sobriety statement, but the program that I attend, I have circles, and the inner circle or the circle where I am out there, so to speak, is just that, me going out searching for prostitutes, going to an adult bookstore, or just so much more. In other words, in my bottom line, and I'm acting out. That's my inner circle. My middle circle is that slippery slope that is a paradox all by itself. This slippery slope is the addictive thinking that I have that may lead to my bottom line behavior. But at the same time, I can stand back and look at my middle circle and say, my God, here I am. It's happening again. Now, it's not obsession, but it's the thinking. and I have a chance to see it for what it is, to feel it, to let go of it, and most importantly, to break the bondage of perfectionism that is so prevalent in all addictions. And then the last circle is my outer circle. What is my outer circle? The things that I love to do. What I'm doing right now, David, is service work. Again, to maybe one, just one person will hear this, and that person may go into recovery. But I love to ride bikes on the road. I love spinning classes. I love to read. I love music. Things that we love. You know, I love God. I love to read about the God of my understanding. David, it's coming to me now. If you don't mind, I'd like to say something about gay life, okay, if I may, that I think is so important.
Sure.
I think it's so important because I heard your when we went on break about your book, and by the way, you are a wonderful author. I'm really happy to know you.
Thank you, John.
Life in America has been persecuted for so long, and as a so-called straight person, I will never understand the extent of the persecution. You know, only I think that the gay people, the culture will. And in my sexual disease, I had both anonymous sex with men and with women. And I remember coming out and saying, oh, well, I'm just gay. That's why I'm feeling so bad. I acted out with this man. So I said, time to come out of the closet. You're praying for a cure. This was going to do it. And, of course, I was not gay. I'm very comfortable saying that. At the same time, the gay people that are listening to this need to know how important it is that along with the persecution, especially when they're young, comes the shame of not fitting in the cultural, you know, BS, excuse me. And it might be a little bit tougher, but we both know of many gay people that are in beautiful sobriety, not just in AA, where it is quite common now, but in the S programs as well. And thank God for that, because gays, like all of us, have an incredible capacity for love, and they are children of God like all of us, and period. Nothing else needs to be said. It's just a beautiful thing to know that God is a God of love. Right, Dave?
That's right. Let's talk a little bit about God and higher power. That's the term that is quite frequently used in 12-step programs, higher power. And I'd like to point out that it is not a religious program. It's a spiritual program.
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about that, Jim, and what spiritual means to you and how you came to define your own higher power and how somebody who might be struggling with the concept of God could frame a higher power for themselves?
Absolutely. When I first got into the program in AA back in 1984, I realized that I felt this flush of peace. What I did know that this peace was the flush of love or the love of God. Spirituality or the search, the continuous search for spirituality, is the opposite of addiction. To be full of love, I can get at a meeting in an hour. I can be full of love that actually spills over so much that I can give it away, where an addiction is an empty vessel. And the more I try to fill that vessel, the deeper and deeper it goes into a void. And, of course, you know, nature abhors a vacuum, so it's an endless hell. Spirituality, for me, or a higher power, again, is an ineffable presence of love. Now, I was brought up Catholic and didn't give a damn about it one way or the other. I was just ambivalent about it. But today, going through all these searches, and David, I have been through the ringer, and it was a lot of fun, actually, because it was all okay, because I was in the programs, and I finally went back to the Catholic Church, but I understand one huge difference, that I respect all faiths, all notions of higher power, to a T. I'll never argue, I'll never evangelize, never. I know that this ineffable love is the same everywhere, you know, in eternity. So for the newcomer coming in, there's nothing you have to do to name your God, so to speak. My suggestion would be just to let go, suit up and show up, and as you get sober and as miracles, real miracles, as you know, Dave, start happening, and this beautiful, we choose to call it grace, for lack of a better word. It's a beautiful word, by the way. As the new person receives this grace, he or she will start to learn more about their higher power. And the best thing about the 12-step programs is, as you said, is not a religious program. It is a spiritual program. And the 12 steps are always geared to spirituality. Remember that they only talk about addiction in the first step. You know, I am powerless over that my life had become unmanageable. Then 2, came to believe. 3, made a decision. 4, wrote a spirit, a past, an inventory. 5, give it up to your higher power. 6, ask God to remove this stuff. You know, 11, sought through prayer and meditation. And 12, freely given, freely give it away. It's the spirituality, I think, in its purest form.
Well, the other thing is there are atheists in the program.
Sure.
And a lot of them struggle with that word God. And
sure.
The thing is they don't need to think in terms of God. They can just, all they need to do is, for instance, use the group as their higher power.
Absolutely.
Look at the collective wisdom that comes from other people, the help they get from other people, that can be their higher power. So nobody
yes.
needs to feel that this program is not a fit for them if they have no belief in God. So I just wanted to make that clear. And
absolutely.
How do you define God for yourself?
Well, personally, my God is the Christian God of the Bible. However, I'm not a literalist, and I am not a fundamentalist, and I'm sorry about those words that it might people might not like what I say here, but I choose the word bibolatry, meaning that people that read the books and go strictly to the word. Do not really know the reason for the beautiful, beautiful stuff. For instance, as you well know, Dave, what like Jesus said, so my God is a God of the Bible. However, having said that, I have a good friend in the program that I sponsor that loves to go to Catholic Church with me so he can pray, that's a Buddhist. He just loves it all. He
mm-hmm.
loves the spiritual. And as far as the atheist goes, that because of our culture, I'm sure, I would love them to know that what you said, calling the higher power the group, is a truism. Because how many times have we been in a group, in a meeting, talking and getting rid of our fears and anxiety and hatred and resentment, letting it go and giving it away, and all of a sudden the whole group feels it, feels this feeling of peace. Well, my God, if that's not
mm-hmm.
a higher power, I don't know what one is.
Right, right. That's great.
It saves lives, Dave. It saves lives.
It sure does. Have you ever had any faith challenges yourself?
Faith challenges while I was in the program, you mean, Dave?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure.
At any point
absolutely.
In your life. And
oh, absolutely.
If you have,
absolutely.
How did you overcome them?
Well, by being human. In other words, another thing about an addiction is we are terminally unique. We think that all of this pain is just happening to us and us alone, and everybody else just kind of lucked out. Well, in recovery, I'm finding out that everybody, addict and non-addict alike, are human. Life is hard. Life is painful. Change is painful. Okay? Sometimes in that change, in that painful times, or I like to use the word seasons, I have doubts, a lot of doubts, and that I go through about believing this or believing that, or sometimes what the heck am I doing, you know? And sometimes mm-hmm. even wishing I was back there, and that's pretty insane. But what happens is I go through it, and I just start to trust again. I go to a meeting, I make a phone call, and I'm centered again. I'm centered in that love of the group, of talking with you on this phone, you know. So sure, I'm human. And as a human, I will have pain. And that's okay. That's a big thing for me today. That's okay. I can be human. That's okay.
You talked about different S programs, and that
yes.
would stand for sex programs for people with a problem with sexual addiction. Would
yes.
you be willing to name some of the programs that are out there for people that might be searching?
Sure. I go to Sex Addicts Anonymous, or it's SAA. There's also Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, and that's SLAA, and I go to that one too. And that basically has more of a addictive love relationship quality to it that we're finding out is pretty addictive. It's not real love. Another one is called Sexaholics Anonymous, and it's a very, very powerful group, and they use the word lust as a drink, thus sexaholics, you know. So you put the lust down, and you put the drink down, and you give it to God, you surrender it, you know. And so there, you know, these are from people that had started it on their own, out of their own enlightened self-interest, out of the pain and insanity of addiction, that were picked, so to speak, to start these tremendous programs. I also hear there's an SCA, Sexual Compulsive Anonymous.
Yes.
God, there's so many, but these are the ones that I'm aware of. Yes, Dave.
And the thing I would like to point out is, take heart. If you can't find one of these programs in your area, different programs exist in different geographic regions. Sometimes
yes.
you'll find more than one program in the same geographic region, but you may live somewhere where there is no program. And don't feel that you're going to be left out, because there are online meetings, there are telephone meetings,
yes.
which can be just as powerful. So please just go in, and if you forget the names of the programs, all you have to do is Google sexual addiction, and it will bring up some of these programs for you, and you can take it from there.
Yes.
What would you say to somebody who's struggling to find their way out of addiction or to find their way back to faith?
When I get a person on a 12-step call, as you well know, you know this too, and see the pain in their eyes, first of all, I can relate to it. The people that are in sexual addiction, I'm just going to pick sexual addiction, know it. They know it. They're not aware of everything, but they know it. The pain is incredible. They're searching and they're seeking help. And I know this because I was one of them when I meet with them. As I see the pain, I basically ask them, do you want this pain? and they look at me and they tear up, and usually it's, you know, of course it's no. And I say to them, there is a way out. I tell them a bit of my story so that they can relate. The beautiful thing about the AA founders is that's exactly what happened. They just related to each other. One was sober for 6 months. The other was a surgeon that was testing this guy. They related because they both knew of the alcoholism and the hell it caused them. And that's what it takes, one relating to another. And David, a person that is not a sex addict, by God's grace, so thank God for that, could never relate to a person that is. My father used to
say...
That's right. Yeah, my father used to say, if you get up in the morning after a heavy night of drinking and you go to work, you're not an alcoholic. You know, and boy, I don't think he was right about that, do you?
No. I used to get up and go to work.
So did I.
In fact, I would punish myself by going to work with a hangover. I wouldn't call in sick. I would beat myself up and pull up my bootstraps and go in and face the music even when I was sick. There are many different ways that these diseases can manifest. And you hinted at some of the other different ways that sexual addiction can manifest, like the pornography addiction, which is very real. And in this age of the Internet, it is, as Patrick Carnes, grandfather of sexual addiction, who's written many groundbreaking books, including Out of the Shadows, would say, the Internet is the tsunami for sexual addiction because there are so many people that are experiencing powerlessness over being on the computer for hours on end, over hookups through different hookup sites. So it has created a whole new arena for acting out behaviors. Let's just try to wrap things up a little bit here, Jim. We're toward the end of the hour. What is your vision for yourself?
My vision for myself, Dave, in a perfect day would be to live this day in sobriety, to do something for someone else that's nice and not let them know it, to read some spiritual books and to possibly get to a meeting if this is my day to go to it. But, you know, I'm human, you know, so I screw up a lot being human. You know, so my vision for myself is to live life on life's terms without acting out in any of my addictions, to repair the wreckage of my past and to freely give to those in need. And people, your audience that are listening to this need to know that not only do I, but it's even written in the big book, there are promises there. If you go to a 12-step program for recovery, you will recover. That's a promise. That's a fact. Any 12-stepper will tell you the exact same thing. And my vision is to see and help others recover. And I pray to God that I can do that. And it's not me doing it. It's the collective, beautiful love energy of the group. And I just want to say, too, David, that you have been an exciting and beautiful person in my life that has given me so much, the conduit for grace has come from you from so many angles, as it is right now as we're talking. And you are a wonderful person of love. And I just love doing this. And I thank you for keeping me sober today, David.
Well, thank you for keeping me sober, Jim, and thank you for your kind words and for joining me today. So now we're going to close the show, and now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts There's no real thing of separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who are having a spiritual experience. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.
You have been listening to Different Strokes for Different Folks. To find common ground and take it to the next level, here on Blog Talk Radio with David Clark, every Friday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. You can listen to this broadcast again on srbroadcasting.com.